KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The Iron Dome has been deeply involved in shooting down remnants of intercepted missiles.
Israel says it has largely knocked out Iran's air defenses and now claims it can bomb much of Iran at will.
For Monday, June 16th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Hundreds of millions of dollars for cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay are in jeopardy in President Trump's proposed budget.
There were a lot more crabs in the 90s, I'd say, late 80s.
Also, President Trump has described himself as a master dealmaker, but how's he faring on the world stage?
And the elevation of a Chicago-born cardinal to become Pope Leo XIV has sparked curiosity about his heritage.
This guy is America writ small, as it were, in his genome. I mean, look at where his ancestors come from.
Those stories ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced they have signed a new trade deal today at the G7 in Canada. The new agreement firms up a trade announcement the leaders made in May. More from NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben.
Talking to reporters alongside Trump, Starmer touted the new deal.
This now implements on car tariffs and aerospace our really important agreement, and so this is a very good day for both of our countries.
Under the deal, a quota of UK steel and aluminum won't be subject to Trump's 25% steel and aluminum tariffs. Similarly, a quota of 100,000 automobiles would be tariffed at 10% instead of 25%. The countries have previously said the deal would give some U.S. exports, like beef and other ag products, greater UK market access. Trump imposed tariffs on nearly every country in April, upending global trade. Since then, Trump has been trying to make one-on-one tariff deals. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Calgary.
The White House, meanwhile, announced Trump will leave the G7 early due to the escalating Mideast conflict. Following a two-day manhunt that took place over the weekend, Vance Luther Belter, 57 years old, was charged with shooting two Minnesota lawmakers and their spouses in federal court. Minnesota Public Radio reporter Melissa Olson was in the courtroom.
Belter appeared in an orange jail-issued shirt and pants in front of federal magistrate John Dougherty at the federal courthouse in St. Paul. Clean-shaven and subdued, Belter stared straight ahead and answered questions from the magistrate judge with either yes or yes, sir. The judge magistrate appointed federal public defender Matthew Dietz to represent Belter. The judge magistrate granted the defense's motion for a continuance and ordered Belter's detention and preliminary hearings combined. The combined hearing is set for June 27th. For NPR News, I'm Melissa Olson in St. Paul.
The Trump administration is defending a possible expansion of travel bans to a dozen more countries. NPR's Tovia Smith reports up to 36 nations may face restrictions on top of the 19 that were already banned or restricted earlier this month.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio sent a memo to the 36 countries that he says have problems, ranging from involvement with terrorism to too many citizens who overstay visas. Some leniency may be granted to nations willing to take other countries' citizens being deported from the U.S., For others, new travel bans could be recommended as soon as August. A Department of Homeland Security official says the move is key to U.S. national security. The countries on this latest list are mostly African, along with Caribbean and Pacific Island nations, as were the countries hit with travel restrictions earlier this month. Critics call the bans racially and religiously discriminatory. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 317 points. This is NPR. With student loan payments back on track after some relief during and after the coronavirus pandemic, millions of Americans are now seeing an effect on their credit scores if they can't keep up. That's because the government is once again referring missed student loan payments for debt collection, and after 90 days of non-payment, the reports are being sent to major credit bureaus. Falling behind on student loans can affect a person's credit score almost as severely as having filed for bankruptcy. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York estimates around 1 in 4 people with student loan accounts were more than 90 days behind in March. The European Space Agency today released the first images from a pair of orbiting satellites that can create on-demand solar eclipses. As Joe Palco reports, the artificial eclipses are used by scientists to study the sun's outer atmosphere.
On Earth, a solar eclipse occurs when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun, temporarily blocking out the sun's light. This reveals the solar corona, a cloud of hot gas made by the sun. The corona is actually hotter than the sun itself. The European space probes, known collectively as Proba 3, fly in tandem, a precise distance apart. The probe closer to the sun blocks the solar light so its partner probe can measure the corona. Unlike on Earth, where total solar eclipses are fairly rare, Proba 3 can create an artificial eclipse every 19.6 hours. For NPR News, I'm Joe Palca.
Despite continued tensions between Israel and Iran, including strikes by each country against the other, oil prices fell a bit today. Oil dropped 1.7% to $71.77 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com and listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. On the fourth day of missile attacks between Israel and Iran, Israel says it has largely knocked out Iran's air defenses and now claims it can bomb much of Iran at will. In contrast, Israel still has strong air defenses in place, but Iran is unleashing waves of missiles nightly, and some are getting through with lethal results. We're joined now by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie for more. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Greg, help us understand, how has Israel been able to defeat Iran's air defenses?
So, Israel inflicted real damage on Iran's air defenses when they had a missile exchange last October. And this time around, Israel says its Mossad intelligence agency secretly infiltrated Iran and was able to take out many of these remaining air defenses on Iran's western border. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel now has a, quote, free highway to Tehran. Mm-hmm. Israel has top-of-the-line U.S.-made F-35 fighters. These and other planes have bombed Iran hundreds of times in the past 4 days, and Israel says it hasn't lost a single aircraft. I spoke about this with Chuck Freilich, a former deputy national security advisor in Israel.
This is anything but a tit-for-tat war. Iran is being hit extremely hard on all levels. It takes some time, but we've already suppressed the anti-aircraft systems and are in the process of doing the same thing to the missile, the surface-to-surface missiles.
Now, if this becomes an extended battle, what does that mean for Israel's ability to hit Iran and particularly its nuclear sites?
So Israel is hitting the nuclear sites, but the two most important ones are very difficult targets. The Natanz uranium enrichment site is largely underground, and the Fordo enrichment site was built deep inside a mountain. Israel is certain to bomb them repeatedly, but it's just not clear at this point whether it will have enough firepower in its arsenal to badly damage or destroy them. Israel may seek help from the U.S. to use its more powerful bunker-busting bombs on these sites. However, President Trump is supportive of Israel, but he says he does not want the U.S. in offensive operations against Iran. So this is not a big issue between them at the moment, but it could become one.
Understood. Okay, well, what about Israel's air defenses? How are they holding up?
Yeah, Israel is shooting down about 90% of Iran's incoming ballistic missiles, and that's roughly what was expected. Several of these missiles hit in Israel on Monday morning, killing civilians in apartment buildings and causing a huge blaze at an oil refinery. Israel has two of its own defense systems for ballistic missiles. One is that called the Arrow. The other is David's Sling. Both are geared for these missiles that fly very high and very fast. The best known system, of course, is Iron Dome, but that's designed for short range rockets. Chuck Freilich says the military has found a novel use for Iron Dome in this conflict.
his Iron Dome has been deeply involved in shooting down the remnants of intercepted missiles, which in some cases can cause as much damage as the missiles themselves.
Greg, last thing, how is the U.S. helping Israel with its air defenses?
Yeah, several ways. The U.S. had two warships in the eastern Mediterranean off the western coast of Israel when Israel launched its attack on Iran last Friday. Now, those ships and the planes on those ships have been actively engaged in combating the Iranian attacks. Now, in addition, the U.S. has sent two top-of-the-line air defense systems to Israel since late last year. These are known as THAAD, and they are operated by U.S. troops on the ground in Israel. So the U.S. is deeply involved in Israel's defense, but at this point, not with its offense.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks as always.
Sure thing.
On his way to the G7 summit in Canada, the president of France made a stop in Greenland to offer his support. Emmanuel Macron's visit to the semi-autonomous Arctic territory follows Donald Trump's renewed threats to acquire it. From the capital, Nuke, Adrian Murray reports.
The French president's jet touched down to rain and thick fog. Emmanuel Macron said the trip was meant to show solidarity from France and Europe.
The situation in Greenland is clearly a wake-up call for all the Europeans. And let me tell you very directly that you are not alone. Everybody thinks in France, in the European Union, that Greenland is not to be sold, not to be taken.
Macron met with the Prime Minister of Denmark and that of Greenland. A meeting meant as a message for US President Donald Trump, who has repeatedly said he wants to take over the strategically important and mineral-rich Arctic territory. Until Trump's election, Greenland's government was keen to boost business and trade with the US. Now, the focus is on rekindling friendships in Europe. Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen says Greenlanders were grateful for Macron's support.
It's a strange time for us in Greenland. We live on some democratic principle built it up for many, many, many years. Respect for international law, respect for borders, respect for law of the sea. And we are glad you could stand with us to state that those principles are very, very important.
Macron drew crowds as he visited the capital and its 20,000, mostly Inuit inhabitants, shaking hands and posing for selfies. Nanna Fredriksson was one of them.
I think it's nice. It's nice that he come and show support for Greenland. The world is very uncertain right now, so it's nice to see that we have some allies.
As he boarded his plane to the G7, Macron said he would tell Trump that Europe was ready to work with the US to ensure Greenland's security and economic development. For NPR, I'm Adrienne Murray in Nuuk.
Hundreds of millions of dollars for cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay is in jeopardy under President Trump's proposed federal budget. As NPR's Scott Newman reports, this comes as the nation's largest estuary, which has long been plagued by environmental challenges, is showing tentative signs of a comeback.
The sun is barely up when Bill Sherbo and his deckhand drop the dock lines and shove off from their home port in Shadyside, Maryland. They're heading out to check crab traps in the shallow water where the West and Road rivers flow into the Chesapeake Bay. For Sherbo, this has been the start to most mornings for the past 45 years. During that time, he's seen the catch decline.
There were a lot more crabs in the 90s, I'd say, late 80s. There are more predators in the bay, but you also have climate changing.
Claws raised in defense, two decent-sized males fall out of a trap and slip around on a stainless steel table. Today it's just two or three per haul, occasionally four, but sometimes none. Sherbo's meager catch for the day, though, belies a bigger picture. Overall, the Chesapeake is on a rebound. Hillary Harp Falk is president of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to the restoration and protection of the watershed.
I grew up in Baltimore City, where you used to see just trash floating everywhere, where you weren't even contemplating swimming.
In its latest annual report card, the University of Maryland's Center for Environmental Science gave the bay a C for overall health, a slight dip from last year's C+, but still an improvement over the string of Ds from years past. Crab numbers are projected to fall again this year, too, partly due to invasive predators like blue catfish that feed on juvenile crabs, and partly due to habitat loss tied to climate change. One bright spot is bay oysters. Almost wiped out in the 1980s, they've tripled their numbers in the past 20 years.
We've seen significant changes, improvements in local water quality. We've seen oysters coming back, underwater grasses in places where we had not seen them for a long time. People are seeing dolphins all around the bay now.
About a decade ago, a Chesapeake Bay Foundation study estimated that the estuary generates over $100 billion annually for the six states within its watershed. Yet efforts to curb pollution have faced persistent challenges, from agricultural runoff to untreated wastewater discharged by towns along the bay. And under the proposed White House budget, key sources of federal support could get cut. Large portions of that would go to the Chesapeake, including part of the roughly $3.5 billion for clean water projects through the Environmental Protection Agency, and hundreds of millions more in rural water and wastewater grants from the USDA. Other agencies would also scale back or eliminate programs that benefit the Bay. Here's Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen.
These are all essential pieces, especially in providing protection to habitat and doing very important scientific work.
NPR reached out to the potentially affected agencies. Some didn't respond. Others, like the Department of Interior, would only say that they support the president's budget bill.
So every one of these small buoys here marks 10 cages on the line. And then the big buoy, that big red one down there, marks the end of the line.
Patrick Hudson runs an aquaculture farm in southern Maryland. It's one of a handful on the bay that have stepped in to fill the demand from restaurants and grocery stores for fresh bay oysters. Hudson's operation supplies his own restaurant in Baltimore and ships as far west as Chicago.
Wow, look at that one. That sort of fingernail growth growing out and nice, beautiful cup, nice white shell. This is what you want to see.
The water around Hudson's farm is unusually clear for the Chesapeake. That's because oysters are filter feeders. They eat algae that causes dead zones. So the farm attracts a lot of species that are vital to the bay's survival. Back on Bill Sherbo's boat, he shows me a tiny crab hauled up on one of the last traps of the day. It's about the size of a half dollar and way too small to keep. It's this year's model, he says, which bodes well for next year. Scott Newman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This past weekend, tens of thousands of people packed Chicago's Wright Field to celebrate the election of the first American pope. Pope Leo XIV addressed the crowd at the White Sox home field in a video recording.
To, once again, the young people who are gathered here, I'd like to say that you are the promise of hope for so many of us. The world looks to you as you look around yourselves and says, we need you.
As soon as then-Cardinal Robert Prevost was elevated to Pope in May, Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. and the team he works with for PBS's Finding Your Roots show began digging into the Pope's family history. Gates recently published the findings in the New York Times, and it turns out the first American pope has a quintessentially American history filled with immigrants, slave owners, enslaved people, scandals, and more. Gates joins us now. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thanks. It's great to be back on the show.
You wrote that this is one of the most diverse family trees we have ever created. Tell me why that is.
Well, let me tell you how I got interested in this in the first place. I'm flying back from Phoenix to Boston. I'd given a lecture at the University of Arizona. And right before I left for the airport, the news broke that the white smoke had appeared. And I don't know about you, but since Pope John the 23rd, I've been fixated on that chimney, you know, on TV, waiting for that magical white smoke. So there it was, and it was an American. So I thought that was cool. So I go to the airport, get on the plane, you know, we're halfway across the country, and I get this text, and the text was from Darren Walker and Dean Baquet. And Darren Walker, as you know, is the esteemed president of the Ford Foundation. Mm-hmm. And Dean Baquet is the former executive editor of the New York Times, a black man from New Orleans. And the text read, Skip, the Pope is black. Dean knows his family. And I went, oh my God, you know, I would have thought it was a joke if it hadn't been from them.
Yeah.
And I get a zillion emails from well-meaning people saying, Dear Professor Gates, you must ask the Pope to be a guest on Finding Your Roots. And so I was thinking of, Your Holiness, could you lower your mitre a little bit so we can make the frame? Your Holiness, could you spit in this test tube, please? You know. But here's what we found. Well, the first issue was, quote unquote, how black is the Pope? Mm-hmm. Of the over 100 ancestors that we found, 17 are black. But the most ancestors are from France, 41, Italy, 24, by the way, both Sicily and Milano, Spain, 21, USA, 21, including those 17 black people, 9 from Cuba, 6 from Canada, 1 from Haiti, and 1 from Guadeloupe.
There's two particular people and two particular moments I'd love to talk about. First, can you tell me about the literal front page scandal his grandfather fell into that directly led to Pope Leo's existence?
Oh, my God. Well, Salvatore Giovanni Gaetano Rigatano Alito was married to a woman named Daisy. And somewhere along the way, things went awry. And Salvatore fell in love with another lady, Suzanne Louise Marie Fontaine. And they had an affair. Daisy filed suit, sought a warrant on behalf of, you know, herself, mm-hmm. and said that the two were, quote unquote, mixed up improperly. And in the same article, it is mentioned that Salvatore had attended seminary to become a priest, but couldn't take his vows. And that extramarital affair produced a son out of wedlock, Jean, or Jean in French, the Pope's uncle, as well as a second son named Louis, who is the Pope's father. And Salvatore gave them both a new name. He took his maternal grandmother's maiden name, which was Prevost. So no more Salvatore Alito was there left in New Orleans. Isn't that a fascinating story?
I just love the fact that a moment of scandal and sin directly leads to a pope.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot there if you want to layer on it. It's just so interesting.
Yeah, and his ancestor. So obviously the pope wasn't the first person on his family tree to think about being a priest.
Yeah. We talked about the black people in the Pope's family tree. We talked about the fact that this included enslaved people, people trying to stay out of slavery. What should we know about the slave owners in his family history?
Well, what's interesting is that we found, not surprisingly for a person from the South, we found that 12 of his ancestors owned slaves. But here's the punchline. Of those 12, 4 were white and 8 were black. And most people don't even know that, I think, that black people owned slaves. But if we take the year 1830, about 1% of the free black population owned slaves. Now, 40% of them owned only one. Often historians think that they were a family member, that the person would keep them under ownership in order to protect them from being, you know, sold to someone else. But the maximum number owned by that group of black people in 1830 was 84. And the Pope's fourth great grandmother, who is Marie Jean in English, has an amazing story. She was enslaved by a man named Francois Lamel. They had a long-term relationship. She was his mistress. They had at least 6 children together. And in 1772, Francois freed Marie Jean and 2 of their daughters. Francois dies 7 years later in 1789. And when he does, Scotty leaves Marie Jean 1/5 of his estate, which included 15 enslaved people. Now, did Marie Jean liberate these people? Not a chance. Wow. In 1817, her holdings had grown to 1,040 acres, including by this time a total of 5 slaves. She enslaved more than any of the Pope's other black ancestors, a total of 20. And, you know, you ask yourself, well, why would black people own slaves? Black people are just as complicated as anybody else. And where the average white person didn't own slaves, the average black person obviously didn't own slaves. But some black people did, and some black people owned a lot of slaves, and Marie Jean was one of them.
Pope Leo is now an important historical figure in the United States of America, even though he's only been that's only been the case for a month. What do you think the story of the first American Pope's family says about the broader American story?
Well, I mean, this guy is America writ small, as it were, in his genome. I mean, look at where his ancestors come from. His ancestors are white and black, from France, from Italy, from Spain, from Cuba, Canada, Haiti, Guadeloupe, and of course, from the United States. I think that he's, symbolically, he's the perfect pope because his very genome expresses the history of the world over the last 500 years.
That is Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr., host of the PBS show Finding Your Roots. Thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
Writer Ta-Nehisi Coates remembers a college classmate, Prince Jones, who was killed in a police shooting years ago.
Prince was like a, you know, a born-again Christian. This model of who you want, you know, your son to be, that I think black parents often fashion.
Jones's death inspired Coates to write Between the World and Me. We speak with him 10 years after it was published on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, young men broke for Trump in last year's election.
What are Democrats doing to try to win these voters back?
They're not lost to the Democratic Party. And if we care about our democracy, everyone needs to feel that their voice can be heard.
That's ahead. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump is in Alberta, Canada for this week's G7 summit, where today he met with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney. As Dan Karpinchuk tells us, Trump says a trade deal with Canada is achievable.
The two leaders were holding a bilateral meeting before the start of the G7 summit. Speaking to the media before their private talks, Trump said his primary focus will be trade and trade with Canada. And referring to Mark Carney on a first-name basis several times, Trump says his approach is about tariffs, but adds that he's sure something can be worked out.
I think Mark has a more complex idea, but also very good. So we're going to look at both, and we're going to see what we're going to come out with something, hopefully.
Trump was critical that Russia was not at the summit, which he says should have been the G8. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
This update, the White House says Trump is leaving the G7 meeting early and returning to Washington tonight amid ongoing tensions in the Middle East. All 50 states, the District of Columbia, and U.S. territories have approved a new $7.5 billion bankruptcy settlement with Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, a pain drug that helped fuel the U.S. opioid crisis. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
This deal is different from a bankruptcy plan overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court last year in that it doesn't force people to give up individual lawsuits against members of the Sackler family who own Purdue Pharma. According to the company, the Sacklers are expected to contribute billions of dollars to the settlement. New York Attorney General Letitia James said this deal will hold the Sackler family accountable for what she described as their leading role in fueling the epidemic of opioid addiction. The Sacklers deny any wrongdoing. This deal is expected to be approved by a U.S. bankruptcy court and would add to more than $50 billion in opioid settlements already agreed to by corporations that made and sold addictive opioid pain medications.
You're listening to NPR News. Federal regulators are reviewing plans to bring back a shuttered nuclear power plant in Michigan. As Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Public tells us, it could become the first nuclear plant in the U.S. to come back online after being decommissioned.
The Palisades nuclear plant sits on the shore of Lake Michigan. The plant stopped operating in 2022. But the company that bought Palisades to decommission it says it now plans to reopen the plant by the end of this year. Steve Scheip is one of hundreds of people working to make that happen. He said at first he didn't believe the plan to reopen was real.
Once I was convinced, I told him to sign me up, so I wanted to be part of it.
Some local residents are opposed to the plan, saying the aging plant is too big of a risk. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids.
A second patient has died in connection with the first gene therapy approved here in the U.S. for muscular dystrophy. The biotech company Sarepta Therapeutics has paused shipments of the drug treatment for patients no longer able to walk, while a panel of experts look at new safety protocols for taking the medication. Sarepta has faced scrutiny after accelerating the approval of its gene therapy back in 2023. Shares of the company were down on Wall Street today. In fact, stocks finished higher across the board. The Dow gained more than 300 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Last fall, Democrats lost ground with young voters, particularly young men. They voted for Joe Biden in 2020, but last year, President Trump narrowly carried the group nationwide. So, have Democrats really lost young men? Well, the party sure hopes not. NPR's Elena Moore is here to talk about efforts to win back this demographic. Hi, Elena.
Hey there.
Okay, so there's the typical political cycle. A party loses an election, they reflect, take a little while to get there. Here we are, what, more than 7 months later? How are Democrats reflecting on what happened with young men?
Well, for one, several emerging leaders who may also be potential 2028 Democratic presidential candidates have appeared to prioritize this group, you know, both in their messaging and through policy proposals. Maryland Governor Wes Moore is one of them. Something he said during his last State of the State address kind of caught my ear. He called attention to declining numbers of young men entering the workforce or earning a college degree, and he directed his entire administration to find ways of better supporting this group. So I wanted to get his thoughts on how Democrats more broadly are engaging with young men.
When you watch oftentimes a party losing people, that's not the head, that's the tail. The reason you lose in election years is because you lost them long before.
And, you know, for his part, Moore told me that addressing the needs of young men has been a long-time priority for him.
A long-time priority for Governor Moore. Okay, but what do we actually know about how young men writ large feel about politics? What's driving their vote?
Yeah, well, we know that economic concerns drove many to vote for Trump last fall, but a new Democratic effort is trying to provide a better picture. It's called the Speaking with American Men Project, described as part research hub, part engagement organization. This spring, they conducted 30 focus groups with young men and commissioned a national survey. And they found that many feel unseen by government officials as they deal with things like economic anxiety and declining mental health. Democratic pollster John Della Volpe is a co-founder of the project and helped lead that research.
This is a generation of young men. They're not lost to the Democratic Party. And if we care about our democracy, everyone needs to feel that their voice can be heard.
The report, Mary Louise, also points to a bunch of online spaces where it argues conservatives have just been more present and Democrats could invest more time.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, we know that Donald Trump, conservative groups who support him, they have invested in non-traditional media. Are Democrats trying to play catch up there?
Well, the report found that YouTube in particular is extremely popular. You know, 95% of young men say they use it weekly, and some Democrats seem to understand that, like former Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg, also, you know, seen as a potential 2028 presidential candidate, by the way. Last month, he appeared on the show Flagrant, which is a podcast hosted by comedian Andrew Schultz, and that's also filmed and streamed online.
We have to be encountering people who don't think like us and don't view the world the way we do, both in order to actually legitimately become smarter and better and make better choices and have better positions, and just in order to persuade.
So, Elena, what is Buttigieg trying to do there? How does an interview like that help Democrats?
Well, because it made him relatable. You know, yes, he talked politics, but he also just, like, hung out, joked around, and answered questions about his personal life. And we've seen Trump use a similar strategy. He's appeared with prominent influencers who aren't known for talking politics, and it's allowed him to connect with people in a new way. Mm-hmm. And these kind of appearances, one strategist told me, are a prime example of how Democrats can begin reaching young men.
Thanks, Elena.
Thanks.
And Pierre's Alina Moore.
Global instability has decreased demand for tabletop war games, as in highly detailed simulations used to predict how the U.S. might fare in a war with, say, China over Taiwan. NPR's Emily Fang got to see how one such war game was played and why people with access to classified information are playing them.
This war game involves three round tables, and on each, a large map of Taiwan and China. There's little blue and red pieces representing submarines, warplanes, and ships, and more than a dozen men all here to play a game, imagining what could happen if China blockaded Taiwan.
If they shoot at us, we shoot back.
The think tank running this game series is the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. They want to figure out how to counter China if it blocked all food, fuel, and arms from getting to Taiwan. Webb Ewell is one of the players.
This thing can devolve into a global economic war rather than a military shooting war if the Chinese choose the blockade route.
Ewell directs a wargaming division at the Center for Naval Analyses, which advises the U.S. Navy. Today, he's playing Team Taiwan, and he's playing alongside Raymond Dubois, another player for Team USA today.
I'm having a lot of fun.
Dubois is a former acting undersecretary of the Army, and at one point, he was the most senior administrator at Pentagon headquarters.
The interesting thing about what we've done over the last 3 years is that these are unclassified games.
Then he mouths to me, no, they're not.
Those of us who are playing come from a background where we're very aware of what's not only on the planning policy side, but on the system side.
Meaning the players often have access to classified information and are aware of the latest weaponry the U.S. commands. Last year, Dubois played another version of today's game simulating a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. In that series, he played Team China.
And we won.
Today's game is messier. The players, including Team China, soon discover how difficult it is to de-escalate from even a blockade. Japan gets roped in. The U.S. attempts to airlift in supplies and cut off trade routes. And it all gets bloody.
So Taiwan does the surface to air, we do the air to surface.
And things in real life also get heated.
So I'm getting no information. I don't even know where the maritime militia is.
That's Ewell from the Center for Naval Analyses. He says the arguing shows the game is working.
You got to get at the human aspects of these problems, in particular risk preferences and things like that. So the whole point is to get people's heads into a situation thinking about how they would actually act if they were in it.
A few hours in, Taiwan offers a surprise truce to China. They offer to have their president resign, to kick out American troops, and to open their coveted semiconductor industry to China. Here's Eric Hagenbotham, a research scientist at MIT's Security Studies Program and a coordinator today for Team China.
So no compliance with U.S. export controls.
Correct.
In return,
what they're asking for is a commitment to not invade the island.
Ever?
Ever. Mark Kansian from the hosting think tank helped design today's game. Out of the four times it's been played so far, two ended in vicious retaliation. He says today's ending was more peaceful.
I would say less violent outcomes because we still ended up with, you know, a couple dozen ships sunk and aircraft shot down and thousands of casualties, but not as much as in some of the previous games where the casualties were much higher.
China's hyped up military drills and military harassment around Taiwan. Military analysts warn China could be practicing for a real blockade. So Dubois argues wargaming is more needed than ever.
The more that people actually really talk to each other about, what do you think the other side will do? If we do this, what are they going to do? If they do this, what are we going to do? I think that's healthy because I think ultimately it prevents a war.
As in, wargames don't just help us test out new defense strategies. They also act as a deterrent because the games show just how deadly war actually is. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. The assassination of Minnesota lawmaker Melissa Hortman has shocked the country, and it's left her community in grief. Clay Masters of Minnesota Public Radio has this remembrance of Melissa Hortman.
It took a couple of tries for Melissa Hortman to get elected to the Minnesota legislature. But in 2004, the attorney won a seat in the state house, defeating a Republican by 2 percentage points. She would go on to serve as minority leader before being elected speaker in 2019. NPR News asked her then what being a woman brings to the job. The question could kind of irritate her.
It's really about the job. And we don't ask that when a man like, hey, Kurt Dowd, are you going to be just like other men?
Hortman was referencing a former male speaker of the house. Here she is accepting the speaker's gavel in 2019.
And that you will faithfully discharge the duties of the office to which you have just been elected to the best of your ability, so help you God.
I do.
Congratulations.
In her acceptance speech, she talked about focusing on the conflicts ahead.
We are not here to avoid conflict. We are here precisely to have conflict. It's an important part of the democratic process. But if we can have that conflict with good humor and humility, we'll be better off, and Minnesota will be better off.
In two decades in elected office, Hortman positioned herself as a consensus builder, willing to work with both political parties. But she was also responsible for ushering in key Democratic initiatives when her party controlled the House, Senate, and governor's office in 2023. She was instrumental in passing abortion rights, universal free lunch for students, and gun restrictions. Former Republican Representative Pat Garofalo was part of the same freshman class.
Melissa Hortman has gone down as the most consequential and impactful Speaker of the House in Minnesota history over the last 160 years. That's the politics of it. The personal side is it's really important that people understand that this was a really good person.
Last year, Minnesota voters elected an evenly divided House. Part of the power-sharing agreement included Hortman conceding the speakership to Republicans. Lawmakers blew past their adjournment deadline, and leaders met for weeks to hammer out a budget deal. After a one-day special session on Monday, Governor Tim Walz took a moment to single Hortman out for her role as a leader.
Speaker Emerita Hortman is amongst the very finest. Her pragmatic ability, her deep knowledge of how the process works, and her willingness to be pragmatic and find deals where it doesn't appear like there was help get this done.
Hortman would be the only Democrat in the House to vote for a measure that removed health care for undocumented adults in the state. The decision was part of a compromise to get a final deal. In what would be her last press conference outside the Minnesota House last week, Hortman was visibly upset.
What I worry about is the people who will lose their health insurance. I know that people will be hurt by that vote, and we worked very hard to try to get a budget deal that wouldn't include that provision. And we tried any other way we could to come to a budget agreement with Republicans, and they wouldn't have it.
She said she did what leaders do, stepped up and got the job done for Minnesota. Hortman was 55 years old. Her husband, Mark, was also shot and killed in their home. They are survived by two children. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tariffs and agreements to reduce them are top of the agenda at the G7 summit in Canada this week. Now, President Trump has described himself as a master deal maker, the guy who wrote the art of the deal. NPR's Mara Liasson takes a look at how he's doing as he negotiates trade issues with the rest of the world.
There's nothing more central to Donald Trump's brand than his self-declared talent at negotiating.
That's what I do. My whole life is like deals, one big deal.
They want to make a deal. And you know,
at the end of this, I'll set my own deals because I set the deal. They don't set the deal. I set the deal.
But so far in this term, Trump has made just one trade deal with the United Kingdom.
He has thrown a whole lot of spaghetti against the wall.
Wendy Sherman was Deputy Secretary of State in the Biden administration.
He said he was going to have 90 tariff deals in 90 days. He said that he would solve Ukraine in a day. He has said that we'll know whether Vladimir Putin is ready for a deal in 2 weeks. He has said that now four times.
So why has Trump had such trouble getting agreements if he's so good at deal making? Douglas Holtz-Aiken is a conservative economist and the former head of the Congressional Budget Office.
The question I get most is, so what's the real strategy behind this? And I have to say with complete honesty, I don't think there is one. He's impulsive. I think it's just, can I surprise people? Can I get them on their heels? And thus look like I won the showdown.
Mike Froman, the former U.S. trade representative under President Obama, says it's too early to judge Trump's record as a dealmaker. But one thing that puzzles him is why Trump sets expectations so impossibly high.
In my experience in government, presidents usually marshal their credibility very carefully. They always want to underpromise and overdeliver.
But Trump overpromises, and so far at least, he has underdelivered. Ian Bremmer, who runs the Eurasia Group consulting firm, has another theory about why Trump has trouble making deals.
Trump has a very good sense of top-line policies that are very popular and got him elected. Fair trade, end the wars, secure the border. But Trump personally has virtually no interest or expertise in the details of policy.
And trade deals in particular are all about the details. One negotiation that seems to have surprised Trump is China. Earlier this month, Trump posted in frustration that Chinese President Xi Jinping is, quote, very tough and extremely hard to make a deal with.
And if Trump thinks he's a, you know, kind of hard ass, a tough negotiator, well, Xi Jinping thinks exactly the same.
Richard McGregor is a China analyst at the Lowy Institute, a think tank in Australia. He watched as Trump slapped high tariffs on China, warned the Chinese not to retaliate. When they did, Trump blinked and lowered the tariffs. He's reversed course like this so many times that Wall Street traders started using the acronym TACO for Trump Always Chickens Out. When a reporter asked him about this, an angry Trump said it was all part of the plan.
You ask a nasty question like that. It's called negotiation, you said.
It's called a negotiation, Trump says. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent calls it strategic uncertainty. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick describes it as a kind of genius.
You don't understand who's the president of the United States. So he's the closer. He gets deals done that we could never get done because he understands deals.
A White House spokesman sent NPR a long list of deal-making accomplishments, including, quote, the return of American hostages from Hamas, a Houthi ceasefire, countries such as Colombia retaking their citizen deportees, the return of Americans detained abroad, and Mexico and Canada shoring up border security. Experts like Bremmer say Trump's on-again, off-again deal-making can shake trust in the United States, but other countries don't have a lot of alternatives right now.
The U.S. is the most powerful economy in the world, and so even if they don't trust the United States, their ability to meaningfully move away from the United States is really constrained in the short to medium term.
In the long term, other countries may move on, find new markets and trading partners, but that won't happen overnight. And in the meantime, Trump will keep trying to make a deal. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Brad Larson. In May 2001, Larson's family gathered at a diner in New York City to celebrate his graduation from NYU.
That would be the last time he saw his mom. She died suddenly just 2 weeks later. About 4 years after her death, Brad decided to return to the diner as a way to connect with her again.
And so I took a seat at the bar, and there were maybe, I don't know, five or six people there and a bartender. And they were all talking with each other like they knew each other. It seemed like a very kind of regulars kind of place. And I was quiet. And at some point, the bartender turned to me and asked me, you know, who I was and why was I there. And it felt like everyone's kind of energy went poof. And I shared that that was the last place that I had seen my mother. And I remember them just kind of immediately wanting to know my story and ask me about my mom and know more about what had happened. And it seems very New York. They were loving and interested. And I was a total stranger, you know, but they were very kind. But actually, like, I hadn't experienced like a group of people to grieve with, really. And at some point, the bartender asked me if I remembered where I had sat with my family the last time. And I did remember, and he invited me to go sit there. The dining room was closed, and all the booths and tables were dark. But he unhooked that kind of velvet rope that they had to rope off the area and let me find the table and take a seat. And I just remember like having this wave of grief come over me and started crying and feeling connected and feeling my mother's presence and feeling a lot of love. And the sort of mini temporary community that these strangers created for me that allowed me to connect with that last moment with my mom. And that experience is, even as I tell it, I feel the tears coming, and it just feels like yesterday. They gave me this moment with my mother. And yeah, that's magical. That's so loving.
Brad Larson lives in Portland, Oregon. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. And from the John...